and welcome to another episode of Indie Darlings, the podcast where we discuss indie films that can be considered indie darlings for good or bad reasons. And our special guest is Bane Gibby.
Yes.
I was so scared I was going to mispronounce your name for some reason.
You did great.
Okay. I probably should have asked that right before we started recording.
There's so many ways that it can go wrong. Okay. My name, and I've heard them all.
Yeah, I don't know why that freaked me out. So all of a sudden, I've talked to you before. I don't know. Oh my God. Okay.
Bane Gibby. Some people want to throw the soft G in there and have it be Gibby. You were right. It's Gibby.
Yeah, I was like, I know it's not Gibby. What's wrong with me? Yay!
Yeah.
Bane, we're discussing the documentary you chose, The Thin Blue Line.
Yes.
And I was fascinated that you chose this because I never would have guessed that you chose it. Why did you choose this documentary?
I know, it was a really strange choice. So I wanted to kind of go with my gut instinct when you told me what the parameters, which were I had to choose between documentary, horror, or what was the other choice?
Taboo.
Okay, yeah. So this documentary has been one of those things that I've been kind of saving. So I remember when I was a kid, my best friend, Amy, I was at her house. And it was the kind of thing where it was almost like a second home. Her parents were kind of like second parents to me. And I remember her dad was watching The Thin Blue Line, probably not that long after it came out. I think he was renting it. So it came out in 88. So maybe it was like 89, 90, something like that. And he was watching it kind of in the like a den. And we happened to look in and we saw the milkshake release of the dramatization where the cop throws.
It's amazing.
And they show it so many times.
Yeah. There's like, what's so funny is, okay, so this movie was made in 1988. And I forgot that in the way they shot stuff back then was a little different.
It's so jarring how dated it feels.
Yeah, it looks like, do you know what it reminds me of? Naked Gun.
Yes.
When they, the opening credits where there's a siren going through stuff.
It's exactly. Yeah, what
yeah, because they do a close-up of a red siren, I want to say every 7 minutes.
They cut back to it an alarming amount of times.
Yeah.
Almost like they only had a few things that they did B-roll of.
Yeah.
And they're like, we'll just cut back to the siren.
Yeah.
So we we poked our heads in and we saw the milkshake release. And of course, we thought it was hysterical because we were sort of like giggly, like in a giggly phase of being a young women.
Mm-hmm.
And her dad was like, this documentary is incredible. Don't laugh. You guys should watch this. This is the fascinating story. And he was really, really, really into it.
Yeah.
So I just remember his sort of passion for it and thinking, oh, at some point I should watch that because it's a memory that stands out. And then I started seeing it kind of come up in my Netflix suggestions and I always sort of noted it, but I was like, oh, well, for another time, right? So when you asked me to do this, I thought, well, this is sort of a perfect, it's not really a current documentary. There'll be something to it. So I shouldn't have been so shocked, but the style, the slowness with which they told the story was so strange to me because I guess we're so used to true crime now being,
it's
different, but it's not documentary, but the style is so slick and they tell the story.
Well, most documentaries now, like seriously, it does feel like an assault of information. Like they throw it at you, but this one, it's like a lot of pauses and
very slow.
It's very linear. Lots of let's take a breath here. But what's interesting is I didn't find it boring.
I didn't find it boring either. I think it was that kind of thing where you have to kind of adjust to the pace where you realize, oh, we're in a different world here where the pace, it's almost like when you watch an episode of Cheers and the opening sequence is like a full minute and the song just keeps going and you realize, oh, this is how opening sequences used to be. It would be like, hey, come in, it's starting, everybody gather around. And they wanted to give you that time because there was no DVR. And, and you're like, oh my God, the opening is still going and it's still going. That's how this felt, where you go, okay, I have to kind of get into a time machine and put myself on this slow moving train, because at the time, and especially remembering my friend's dad's reaction, he was rapt, you know? And so it, but in this viewing, I kept sort of thinking like, am I, it was like, I felt stoned. Like it was going at such a slow pace.
I mean, it's definitely like, it felt more like a movie than a documentary.
Yeah. Well, there was so much dramatization. And by the way, the dramatizations were so amazing.
It was so amazing. There's so many moments where I just burst out laughing.
So funny.
And it wasn't even just because, oh, this is so out of date. It would just be the way they edited it.
Like, yeah.
They would show someone talking and then the next, they would cut to someone else like, I thought she was trash. And I was like, oh, I love this movie. like, cause there's so many characters in this. Okay. Let's get into it.
Yeah. Let's get into it.
So if you haven't heard, The Thin Blue Line, the 1988 documentary by Errol Morris, score by Philip Glass.
Amazing music right from the opening sequence.
Very memorable.
Yeah.
And it's the story of a drifter named Randall Adams. Oh, the crime happened in 1976 to add even more funky images.
Yeah, and seeing how their hairstyles change
the
over
car,
the...
Everything. So this happened in Texas. And okay, so it's a story of two men, Randall Adams, a drifter, and David Harris, a blue-collar criminal?
Yeah, 16-year-old.
Which is crazy to me.
So young.
Yeah, okay, so David Harris picks up the hitchhiker, Randall Adams, and then later a police officer gets shot that pulls over the car that they're in, and Randall Adams gets pinned for the murder. But you would think... Okay, so you would think that... okay, so... Dave Harris stole his dad's car, had weapons in the car.
Had multiple charges
priors
to this.
When they were interviewing him for this, he was in jail for something else.
He was in jail for something else.
He bragged to his friends that he shot a cop.
Meanwhile, Randall Adams, no record.
No record.
Clean as a whistle.
Yep.
Just maybe kind of a strange guy.
Yeah.
And the biggest...
didn't he have alibis?
He had alibi of his brother. That he had been, he was staying at the motel with. He had watched the Carol Burnett show, which was from 9 to 9:30 at that time. and that's amazing because they cut to sort of like the TV guide that shows, the time.
But it's like the story of the unluckiest man alive. Every opportunity that should have, set him free made it worse. They show the lawyer who's supposed to be defending him, a woman who at one point says, I guess I'm pretty gullible.
That woman was amazing, by the way, the character. She kept taking her glasses off and on in the interviews. And if you go and get into this movie, people who are listening, when she takes off her glasses, she reveals this enormous mole on the side of her nose that the glasses were covering up.
Oh, boy.
Did you notice that?
I did not.
And
oh,
so it's almost like
no.
I thought she would wear the glasses to
hide
it and then kind of forget and take them off and then get self-conscious and put them back on.
Oh, man.
But it was this almost like this Easter egg, like every time she took the glasses off and you just see this enormous mole.
Everyone interviewed in this documentary deserved their own documentary. It was so fascinating. But what's okay, so she talks about the case and how it wasn't handled correctly. And then they talk about the person, the prosecutor, They show a picture of him. He looks like a cartoon villain.
Mm-hmm.
Like he never loses a case. Like the most vicious lawyer. Yeah. And I'm like, what the fuck is this?
And they show typed out records of like all the cases he won.
Uh-huh.
You know, life, death. You know, like with typewriter.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
It's like.
Yeah, like he has like an amazing record.
Yeah, he was hot, hot, hot.
Yeah, and then the woman defending him, like she looks like a character out of a Todd Solondz film, and she's just so like you could not have chosen a darker horse. I'm like,
yeah,
what is happening?
Like it looks like she would have trouble just getting through the course of a day.
Yeah, I wouldn't trust her to be a lawyer's assistant, exactly. Let alone a lawyer. And okay, so they're going to prosecute. They're trying to give him the chair.
Yeah.
And okay, so they bring on witnesses, and it's the worst case scenario.
I mean,
witnesses.
One thing is just crazier than the other. The woman with the bleach blonde hair.
Oh, I loved her. She's so crazy.
Was so crazy and said, like. That she had this really intense fascination.
She says, I always want to play detective.
Yeah.
I try to solve the murders before the cops do.
I'm always looking around to see who's going to get
killed.
Being nosy,
asking questions. And I was like, oh my God.
I mean, you would think that she would have been thrown out. Like if she had gone to show up for jury duty.
Yeah.
And she had said those things. They would be like, you're not fit to serve
on a jury.
Yeah,
you're
going
to ruin this case.
Completely biased.
Yeah.
You obviously have ulterior motives. You want to go into some fantasy land. And,
yeah.
And yet then the reveal is that she and her husband were in trouble.
Yeah.
Because they'd been arrested for just like domestic abuse or like disturbing the peace because of an argument.
Yeah. Some sort of domestic disturbance, but they both had warrants out for them. And on top of that, when her husband... Was it her husband? It was someone else when they heard that there was reward money for information.
Yeah.
A neighbor literally heard the guy say, I'll say anything
for the right price.
Yeah.
So again, their credibility is totally shot. And but she claims that she happened to be driving past the scene of the shooting and that she could exactly see into the window and that it was the unluckiest man alive, Randall Adams.
Uh-huh.
And he claims, I was home watching the Carol Burnett show.
Uh-huh.
Now, the thing that I felt like was the greatest mystery and omission in the entire thing was, why did a 28-year-old grifter man, Randall Adams, even strike up a friendship earlier that day with a 16-year-old boy, and what was going on there?
I wanted to dive into that. Okay, so here's the thing. Okay, so Randall Adams is 28. David Harris is 16. Just turned 16.
And he looks like a boy, by
the
way.
Like he just turned 16. And he looks like the kind of guy that just stole his car. His dad's car. Okay, so he picks this guy up. And here's the thing. They spend the day together.
They go to the movies.
Yeah.
They go to a bar.
Yeah.
So, and not one time in this film is this unpacked. Like, what's going on
part
here?
Okay, so they go to a movie theater and they go to a double feature.
They go to drive-in, which is very romantic.
Well, here's the thing. It's the 70s. And it was like a drink and sit.
Yeah.
He called it. So they're like, you could drink a beer and sit and watch the movie. I'm like, that's okay. I forgot it's the 70s. So drinking and driving is not a thing illegal yet. But okay. So they pick David Harris, the 16-year-old. He picks a double feature and they're both kind of
like horny,
softcore porn movies.
Like the first one was like, he said a cheerleader.
I wrote down the names of the movies.
Yeah. Let's get into that.
Okay. Let's see.
Because Randall said he didn't like them. Which
Student Body was the first one.
Student Body.
And the second one was Swinging Cheerleaders.
And they do show clips of these films within the documentary. And Randall, who never, it's never discussed or no one gets into whether he's gay or not. But he says, I really didn't care for this movie and I wanted to leave. And I was telling him, I want to get out of here.
Uh-huh.
And it was like a flashing, you know, neon sign of like, okay, so pick him up earlier? Was there sex at any point during this day?
Yeah. Like the whole time I'm like, oh, was this a date? Or was this like...
It's like a grifter date.
Yeah. I was like, because I'm like, I don't understand why the two of you would be spending the day together. That could be the only reason.
And so they go back to the motel. Uh-huh. Now, I really wish we could have heard from Randall's brother, who's just silent. Never interview him.
Okay, Randall's brother tries to cover for him by lying to the cops. And then the cops say, you know, if you get caught lying in court, you'll go to jail. So he retracts his story. And so you never hear from his brother, who made the weirdly foolish move of trying to lie about it.
Thinking, which leads me to believe he thought, oh yeah, my brother's a weirdo and maybe he did
something. I think his brother thought he was involved.
Right.
Which so is he, very he makes saddening.
The, sort of like, you know,
he's like, I
pulls
got
the
you.
Trigger on yeah. that. But the brother's back at the motel, Randall and the David, drive to the motel, and Randall says, I'm going to go in and ask my brother if it's cool if you stay.
Uh-huh.
But he's probably going to say no.
Uh-huh.
He goes into the motel, never comes back out again. And at a certain point, David's like, I guess I'm on my own, and leaves.
Uh-huh.
And later, when we sort of discover that it was probably him, he does all but confess. He says, well, yeah, it's sort of his fault, because if I was sleeping in that motel, I wouldn't have been out killing a cop. And I'm thinking, why would he even think he had a place to stay unless earlier in the day something went down between these two? Unless I'm just not up on, like, the grifter. Like, maybe people were just like, hey, I met you 6 hours ago. Come stay in my hotel. Maybe that was kind of more common.
It was also the 70s, so I know that people were a little bit more reckless back then.
Yeah.
But I'm just like, okay, so here's what I'm thinking. Because I also, the whole time during this movie, I'm like, it's crazy that a police officer pulls him over for not having his lights on, and he immediately shoots him multiple times. And because... it makes sense that the car's stolen. He's got priors. Why he would want to run. But full on murder a police officer right away. I'm like, what was happening there?
Yeah.
So the idea that he... Okay. It's falling into place now.
Yes.
Okay. So I'm thinking he thought he was going to have a place to stay with the man he might have hooked up with that day.
He's feeling emotionally
got rejected.
Hurt. Yeah.
And when he got pulled over by the cops, I think that's when he hit a wall.
And he just snapped.
Yeah.
And then they do bring in sort of the possibility of a race thing.
Yeah, because the cop that got shot was, I think, Mexican.
Yeah, it was dark skinned.
Yeah.
And they said it was a primarily black neighborhood where the car was pulled over.
Yeah.
And the idea from the cops was, oh, we think that the murderer thought that the cop was black and it was kind of a hate crime.
Yeah.
And that he was just sort of waiting there to shoot him, which seems none of it makes any sense. No.
Yeah. They had this whole red herring of the Klan is involved. People don't want this case solved because, the cop's not white, or, the Klan is helping the killer, but
right.
I think that was all a red herring. Another unfortunate wrench in this mess was that the other cop was a woman, and she was one of the first female cops in Texas, and which was to her detriment, to because the cops describing what happening are just ripping her to shreds.
Because she could have been sitting in the car sipping on a chocolate milkshake when she was supposed to actually be outside the car at the ready.
Yeah.
And they had the liquid evidence that she had thrown the milkshake, which is why they showed that clip over and over and over again.
It's so unfortunate because
she really messed up.
She fucked up hard. Like, okay, so I didn't know this, but like police procedure, when you pull someone over, both cops are supposed to get out.
To get out, which I didn't know this either.
Yeah, I didn't know that, but it makes sense why now, because the guy got shot.
Yeah.
and she was still in the car. She didn't see the guy, and she could not remember
anything about the license plate.
She couldn't remember the license plate at all.
Two letters, but maybe they weren't completely correct.
On top of that, she described the car, but she described it incorrectly. So they were looking for the wrong car for
a long time.
Yeah.
And it was like almost the same car, but just slightly different, but enough that they said they wasted so many man hours looking at all the wrong cars.
It took me a while to notice because like they kept showing, they did so many zoom ins on the taillight of a car.
Yes.
And I'm like, we get it. But then eventually it's like, oh, it's because the two cars that she was confusing
have different tail
lights. They have different tail lights. And I'm like, oh, that's
a
biggie.
It's safe to say she was in such a state of shock and disarray that she didn't remember. Whereas if she was supposed to be standing outside of her vehicle watching, which again, I don't see this represented in too many TV shows or movies, so I didn't know this.
Yeah.
I feel like you always see the second cop just kind of like
chilling.
You would be focused on, like, you would have time to clock the license plate. But it's very unfortunate because then they were able to just completely dismiss her as not only like a terrible cop, but like kind of dumb and sloppy and lazy.
Yeah. A female cop.
Yeah.
And they're just, oh, and they even brought in a hypnotist to help her remember.
And they showed us a nice visual of a pocket watch going back and forth. It reminded me of The Secret. Have you ever seen The Secret video?
No.
Well, when that first came out and they were telling you all about how to manifest things, they would literally show like a spinning key, like over and over again. And like a pocket watch going back and forth to try to get you like in a relaxed state of mind, but also for similar reasons, like they needed graphics and they just kept reusing the same thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, the pocket watch as hypnosis, I was like, I don't actually think anyone still uses that except in carnival like recreations.
I remember there's an episode of Different Strokes where Arnold has to remember where his sister was kidnapped. So they bring in a hypnotist, but he doesn't use a pocket watch.
He just talks to him.
Yeah, he just talks to him. So, yeah, I think even for back then, that was a bit
even
much.
Even in the 70s when Different Strokes was on. I didn't remember that Arnold's sister was kidnapped.
Oh, yeah. They both kind of get kidnapped, but Arnold manages to run away, but he doesn't remember where from.
Okay.
Yeah, so they have to get a hypnotist to help him remember where he went.
Oh, gosh.
I know, it's insanity.
That must have been one of the more dramatic.
You know that was based on something that happened.
Of course.
And that's so crazy.
It's like the episode where Rodney gets touched. And there were a couple of episodes of Different Strokes that were just like
whoa.
Maybe a little edgy for
life
me.
Life is dark.
Yeah, life is dark.
There's so many great moments in this documentary. Did you notice the bumper sticker on the car?
Yes. What did it say? Something about... How's your love life?
It says, I'm a lover. How's your love life? And I'm just like, what does this mean?
Now, do you think that she recalled that it was some sort of groovy bumper sticker and they made that up? Or do you think that was like an art direction decision to say, we're in the 80s now. We have to remind people that this crime happened.
In the 70s?
In the 70s.
Well, I mean, I feel like Randall's hair should have been enough of a giveaway because he had like a huge kind of fro that they referenced many times in the case.
Yeah.
And yeah, just there were so many aspects of it that were very 70s because they talk about smoking marijuana.
We smoked a little marijuana.
Which might have led to the murder.
Right, yeah, because when everyone gets nice and high,
you
get
smoke
real
those jazz
violent.
Cigarettes. Let's see.
You know, Randall's demeanor, I think, was something, too, that they, you know, I've noticed this in a lot of cases where they say, you know, this person had no remorse. They're clearly a psychopath. And really... he had sort of this like slow Texas way of talking.
Here's the thing. I just saw a note of mine. Okay. So when David and Randall were hanging out, David's bragging about all the guns he has.
Yeah.
Which Randall made him put in the trunk. One of them, he had a gun and while they're driving, David shoots it out of the window, just starts shooting it in the air. And Randall's like, stop that.
Yeah. Can you put it up? Yeah. Uses that phrase, which I thought was strange. Yeah.
And then, but here's the thing. They still kept hanging out after that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, someone just starts shooting from the car you're in, and you're just like, hey. So anyway, it's...
So again, it's almost like this grifter relationship. Oh, I met this guy. We smoked a little marijuana. We went and saw a movie. We had some beers. He was kind of weird. He started shooting his gun. Uh-huh. But I didn't foresee that he was going to actually kill anybody.
Yeah.
But the shooting the window, like the gun out the window, didn't raise too many red flags that I said, like, get the fuck out of my car.
Yeah.
You know, so again, it shows that like things were just really different culturally. Cause if I met someone and all of a sudden they were like, look, I got this gun, bang, bang, bang.
Yeah. Like, I'd be like, please get out. This is where you get out.
This fun, whimsical day that we've had together has now come to an end.
There's so much insanity. Okay.
Randall stays very calm for somebody who has had this happen to him. Mm-hmm. And we call him the most unlucky man alive. He doesn't show a lot of anger.
Yeah.
It's bubbling there.
Yeah.
But it's almost like that was used against him because then they said, you know, he showed no remorse. He is apathetic. And really, he had this kind of thing where just like almost this hollow way of saying like, I didn't do it, you know, but he never was like, I swear, like how you see a lot of people. I never did it. I wouldn't kill it, you know.
Yeah. You'd think they would get emotional. But here's the thing, that on top of being accused of murder, the cops treat him terribly.
Horribly.
They pull a gun on him.
He's garbage.
Yeah. They try to force him to confess. They literally hold him at gunpoint.
Yeah, that part is really disturbing.
I know, and I'm like...
They type out a confession that's fabricated.
Yeah.
And then they threaten him, to threaten to shoot him when he won't sign it.
Yeah, and I'm like, how does that... That alone should have just ruined the case.
There are so many things that made little sense like that, where when it became clear that he didn't do it...
Yeah.
He still was serving jail time.
Yeah.
Why?
At that point, I feel like it must have been an issue of just pride on the cop's behalf. Because what sucks is, okay, so he was potentially going to get the chair, but because of a glitch, he couldn't. Okay, so they switched his thing to a life sentence.
Yeah.
But there's a weird catch-22 where if you get a life sentence, you can't get a retrial.
That's it. That's what it was. And he was saying, you know, we're talking about me getting the chair. We're talking about everyone's telling me, you know, your eyes are going to pop out and this is going to happen to you.
Yeah, everyone's telling him horrible things about, like, your fingernails are going to pop off and stuff.
And he's over here thinking, like, I was at home watching the Carol Burnett show. My brother was there. How is this my life?
Uh-huh.
The interesting thing about the way they rolled out the story was, you know, we had no concept of why David was a murderer, like this kid.
They tried.
Until the very end.
They kind of tried to figure it out, but so they dive into David's past.
At the tail end.
But here's another weird thing. Not only did Randall get treated horribly, but the police that arrests David weirdly like him and they talk about how they goofed off with him and stuff. Like there's a scene where I forget.
They talk about it. It's almost like this bias that we see a lot today where they're like, we didn't want him, this 16-year-old,
we don't want to ruin his life.
And we're like, but this 28-year-old grifter guy,
he's good to go.
Who's seemingly like a pretty okay guy. Like he'll take one for the team kind of thing. Whereas like, we don't want this young, and let's be honest, like blonde haired, you know, kind of all-American boy.
Yeah.
Like, that would be such a shame if his whole life was ruined. And meanwhile, he went on to, like, rob and murder and assault women and like do all these horrible things that he then was incarcerated for.
Yeah. Like he ended up in jail anyway because he committed further serious crimes.
Yeah.
And it's just, and it's not like it wasn't like a case of, I hate to say this, boys will be boys. He shot a police officer point blank.
Point blank multiple times. Yeah. I think there was like 5 or 6 gunshots.
And I'm just like, this is really unfortunate, but when they do the
spinning siren.
Oh, no. When they show the police officer getting shot, they show a torso do a spin.
He almost does like a jazz turn.
Yeah, a spin and
then
a fall.
It was so graceful. He does like a jazz turn and then falls almost like doing the worm down.
Like part of me wishes I was there and been like, guys, I understand that he probably fell at a weird angle, but can we not put so much?
Yeah.
Have you seen Showgirls?
Ugh. So long ago, though.
Okay. Well, there's a part where the one note she gets on her dancing is, Nomi, what kind of turn is that? Do a PK turn.
Right. It was very jazz. It was very jazz and it was very graceful.
Like, I don't think I could do that turn.
And it was almost like they were trying to show that the force of the bullet made the chest spin, but it was.
But it spins so.
So gracefully.
So gracefully and so weirdly horizontally that I was just like.
No.
We need less spin.
We need less of a PK turn. I completely agree with you. I found that. And also in the release of the milkshake, it was like one of those.
It was the most beautiful, like safer way.
Release, it was literally like a jazz hand out, and then a retract into a fist. And I'm like, nobody retracts into a fist after they throw something. They're just like,
yeah, it wasn't a drop. It was a eruption.
It was like a musical theater.
Yeah,
it was a musical theater milkshake.
Yeah,
toss.
like a dancer from
and then
Cats
a retraction
through that milkshake.
And it's funny because at no point did the director go like, just throw it like a human, like just throw it like a normal human would throw a piece of garbage.
Yeah.
Who's in a rush, not like da 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 da.
5, 6, 7, 8
throw. And again, it just shows like in these 20 years how it's like they do dramatizations now, but they put like a filter on it and they shadow it and everything so that any kind of weird discrepancies don't take you as much out of the story.
They always make things look grimy and like, oh, like dark and hopeless. But this is like,
this looks like a soap opera.
Yeah.
Set.
Like the greatest thing Miramax has to offer this year. And like another weird thing I noticed is that they talk about the restaurant, the fast food restaurant where the cops went to right before the murder. And they're like, they stopped by, they keep saying
Burger King.
They kept saying a fast food restaurant. But what was so funny is when they redid it, they clearly showed
Burger King
label.
And they showed the logo like in the window.
Numerous times.
And then they showed the logo on the cup.
Yeah, I'm like, was there a weird thing with
like
the audio?
Like you couldn't say it.
Yeah, they couldn't say it, but I'm like, we're definitely seeing it.
We're definitely a Burger King. And then it'd be great if like they cut back and she's wearing like one of those crowns.
Oh, God. Oh, worst day of everyone's life.
Milkshake release and then crown release out the other.
Oh, my God.
The actress who played the female cop, too, is like, it was like she couldn't imagine what it was like to feel adrenaline. Because when they showed her acting, like coming out of the car and shooting the gun, it was just like, and here I am and I'm shooting again. Pew, 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 pew. Like there was no acting involved. And again, it's one of those things where I'm like, the director didn't say like, you just saw your partner get shot. You'd be a little bit upset.
Everything was just so like nothing felt. Because the thing with most true crime docs is that there's a point where things get gruesome or grimy. Nothing felt like that with this. Like even the gunshots, they're like, it sounded like popcorn.
Oh, we heard some like it was like a backfire or some fireworks.
I thought
or
I heard fireworks, but it's not the 4th of July.
Yeah,
and I'm like,
exactly.
I was like, nothing about this is
gruesome. And can we discuss that the other eyewitness was a guy who was like, I'll be honest. I was driving by with a lady who is not my wife. he's like, and so I couldn't say anything because if my wife found out I was with a lady, she would kill me. It was straight out of Central Casting. I mean, this
it was great. Everyone had a backstory, fully formed characters. Mm-hmm. He's like, I was driving a lady friend home. It was 2 o'clock in the morning.
Not my wife.
Yeah, so you can understand why I wouldn't say anything. And I'm like, this is amazing. This is so wonderful.
I also felt like the story, while it's an interesting story, I feel like we've become accustomed to current crime stories having so many more twists and turns. Mm-hmm. So again, I found myself kind of being like, oh, this is it? You know, there's not like a whole other reveal that there was like a third person involved. Yeah, and just makes me realize how we've evolved to not just being used to kind of like the slick editing and this and that, but that there's, you know, with like the podcast Serial and stuff or S-Town or whatever, like, mm-hmm. like, oh, and there's like this cliffhanger and then you didn't see this coming. And like, we keep expecting things to be just kind of heightened and heightened and heightened. Mm-hmm. Whereas this, again, I had to kind of remind myself like, oh yeah, this is the story.
Yeah.
Like, this is it.
Yeah.
And it still is an extraordinary story, but I was like, it almost seemed simple mm-hmm. compared to like The Jinx or like Making a Murder or things where you're like, oh my God, and then that happens. And
another thing about it is I feel like also because this story, this is from 1988. And a lot of those stories are a little bit more current. But I also wonder, I think for the time, the horror from this is supposed to be the massive failure of the legal system, as opposed to like, it's actually a bunch of bodies under the basement.
Or, right. And yet it doesn't really leave you, you don't really get a catharsis because they're like, oh, there's this massive failing and this poor guy's life was taken from him and then it ends.
Yeah.
And there's nothing that kind of makes it right or makes you feel like that David had any remorse at the end. He kind of goes, yeah, well, like, you know, he didn't do it.
Here's what's so crazy to me. Okay, so they interview a bunch of David's friends who seem like they would be David's friends. And
they're like, he was bragging about it. Well, I just didn't think he was telling the truth.
Well, here's what's so crazy to me. They interview like three dudes that seem like they'd be his friends. And they're like, that man, he has no conscience. That's the thing about him. And I'm like, why are you friends with him?
Right. I guess they're teenagers.
Yeah. And he was bragging about how he shot a police officer to everyone who would listen. And they're like, sure, David.
Yeah.
Sure.
We just didn't think it was possible. It's like he said it multiple times.
And you all said he has no conscience.
Yeah.
And I'm like.
So again, it's almost like we're so much more savvy now. Like they just were like, it was all right there, but we just didn't believe it because who would believe that? You know, I guess we've seen so much now that we're like, no, if someone tells you they shot someone, you should.
Yeah, maybe look
respond.
Into it.
Respond.
Yeah. But I'm okay. So they talk about David's childhood and there is some trauma there in that.
Major.
He had a brother 1 year apart when they were like 4 or 5. His brother drowned. But.
And it was essentially the dad's fault. So what happened was they were in a little kiddie pool in the yard splashing around. Uh-huh. I thought it was going to be that he drown in the kiddie pool, but no, it's that the dad was supposed to be watching. The brother walks down the street to sort of this old man's house who has a really nice pool. He jumps in the pool and drowns while the dad is in the garage, like filling around with a car or something. And then the dad, probably because of all the guilt, is really mean to David and treats him badly.
He keeps saying how he's David felt like he was a never-ending reminder of what happened.
Yes.
And then his mom had another baby, and the dad treated him like the favorite.
Like the prince, yeah. And so he was always made to feel like the reminder, and then the next kid that came along was like the golden child.
Yeah.
And
the resentment, you know, built from there. But then, so they lay that out for you and you're like, oh, that does sound extremely traumatic. However, then there's this leap from like, God, I was so angry. My dad was a dick and my brother died, to I murder people in cold blood.
Yeah.
And let somebody else do the time for it.
Like, not just let, like, he kind of helps steer the cops in that direction. And I'm just like, okay, your childhood sounds like it sucked, but nowhere in there does it lead to, oh, this guy's going to commit multiple murders before the age of 21.
Yeah, and then the title is interesting because I didn't know that that expression had a meaning, the thin blue line, which means that there's a very small boundary between chaos and order, essentially.
Oh, I wrote down the quote.
Yeah,
A police officer, he says, the thin blue line, we represent the thin blue line of police separating the public from anarchy. And apparently, I was Googling this, that's a reworking of a Rudyard Kipling poem, Tommy, which is talking about British soldiers, called the Thin Red Line.
Okay.
Based on their formation and uniforms.
Okay.
Yeah, so in a Kipling sense, the British soldiers would represent the thin red line amid the countries they're colonizing, whereas the thin blue line is the police in the U.S.
Right. And yet it was a total fail.
Mm-hmm.
And so essentially it's anarchy anyway in this case, because Adams went to jail.
Life for life. And he got failed numerous times, like along every step of the way, with his lawyer, eyewitnesses, and even when they found out that, when it was pretty clear that he wasn't the one that did this, they still wouldn't let him out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, what's happening here?
Well, and there's nobody really seemed to care.
Yeah. Like, there's really no one in Adams's corner being like, no, I'm not going to give up.
And you wonder, okay, what happened to the brother? Like, why was he not, like, in a lot of these stories, you see the family is the one, like, even in Making a Murderer, the mother is like faxing documents and like trying to right the wrong. And it just seemed like Randall Adams had no people, or his people were like, didn't have the capacity to do anything.
Well, what was strange is Randall didn't seem to be fighting for himself either. So I'm just like, is he not fine with it, but I'm just like, what's with him?
He almost seemed like he had, I don't want to say like he was on the autism spectrum, but it almost seemed like he had some odd way of removing himself. Like the way that he, like when I said, oh, he couldn't really access anger, it was like maybe even deeper than that, where he wasn't passionate when he was talking about it. He didn't speak in a way where he behave like he'd been done a massive injustice. He was like divorced from the situation in an odd way.
He might be like, have trouble expressing emotion, period. Cause I mean, it sounds like him and David had a crazy day, but
doing, we don't know exactly what.
I mean, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall. Because I'm sure every moment is just so cringeworthy.
Well, it's also like they're socializing as if they're peers.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're 28 and you are with a 16-year-old, I feel like when you're a normal functioning 28-year-old, you're like, oh, I'm like a lot older. Like, I don't have anything in common with this person. They're a teenager.
Like, he was almost half his age.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's so much possibility. And there's so much, like you said, that could have gone wrong that then gave David the fuel to be like, fuck that guy. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm going to let everybody think he did this terrible thing because he hurt my feelings,
uh-huh,
or because he did what he did or wouldn't do, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it can't be good. Something sorted went on for sure.
Yeah, there's definitely some pieces missing to this puzzle. And
nobody from David's family is represented in this entire documentary.
Nope.
Not one story, not one anything other than the background he provides in the picture he provides about his childhood in the 50s, essentially.
Yeah, I think both cases David and Randall, they're both just like, fuck it. Yeah, it's so unfortunate and so crazy. But as a documentary, I think this is praised as being one of the most important and
it's
best documentaries.
100% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, and I could see why. It's pretty amazing. It's, I think it holds up considering it was made in 1988.
Yeah.
And aside from the campy cinema style.
You just have to sort of forget about that.
Just let it wash over
you. Yeah, you let it wash over you and enjoy it too because it's so delicious.
Everyone they interview is just, I'm like, wow, what are you like, man? Like, you're just so, every single person, the eyewitnesses, the cops, the lawyers, every single person, I'm just like, whoa, wow.
Yeah, and there's so much failing that it kind of brings to mind a terrifying feeling of like, this was not that long ago. It was only 20 years ago. There's obviously still a huge amount of this behavior going on where just sloppiness, eyewitnesses. I mean, there's every eyewitness is bringing a whole world of like their experience to this, mm-hmm. their bias, who knows where they were coming from.
Yeah.
They're not really like 100% ever, you know, like there's so many ways that it can all go awry. And uh-huh. this is an example of like the perfect storm of everything that could have gone horribly wrong did.
Uh-huh. Wow. It's okay. So I have to bring up, have you seen that show Documentary Now?
Yes.
Oh my God. Okay. So they parodied this movie in my favorite episode of Documentary Now called The Eye Doesn't Lie.
Mm-hmm.
I rewatched it today for this.
You did.
I've already seen it like 3 times.
There's a great sign spinner in it, right?
Yeah. Okay. Instead of a cop, they shoot a guy who's a sign spinner.
Yes, yes.
And they really do a great job of mimicking the dramatic B-roll.
Yes, and they do the taillights and everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But instead of a milkshake, it's a creamsicle. And there's so many beautiful notes they hit where, okay, because the Thin Blue Line ends with the last interview with David, which is on. They just show a visual of an audio cassette recorder.
Yeah, like an old fashioned mm-hmm. recorder.
Being like, well, I suppose if I had a place to stay that night, he wouldn't be
being
in jail.
All coy and.
Yeah. But in Documentary Now, it goes, well, he sucks though. And then the interviewer's just like, yeah.
I completely forgot about that until you brought it up, but I've totally seen that. Yeah, oh, yeah. They do such a good job of.
Well, what was, I don't know if this was a disadvantage to me, but I had seen that episode of Documentary Now several times before I saw A Thin Blue Line.
Yeah.
And I was just like busting up and I'm like, they captured this beautifully. They captured that beautifully. Yeah.
But they get all the styles, like the Grey Gardens one mm-hmm. that they did is so good.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's coming from someone who's seen Grey Gardens like a million times.
Oh, yeah.
And the one where they parody the Blue Jean band, like the duo, sort of like Hall & Oates.
Yeah.
I mean, it's because I love documentaries so much that, like, I feel like they nail the styles.
Oh, they always nail the tone. Yeah. They always nail the tone. It's just, yeah, I also like that they took some liberties with this
mm-hmm.
and that they changed the case a bit. But,
yeah, it's so good.
I love that they, okay, so for the real life case, you're not 100% clear why David chooses to frame or help frame Randall. But in the Documentary Now case, it's the moment when, Bill Hader's character puts in a poison tape and then Fred Armisen's like, no, thank you, takes it out.
And it probably was something like that.
Something really small.
Or it was like, how about you touch my dick?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he's like, no. But you could touch mine. You
know? And so he's like, this guy sucks.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the big question. But mm-hmm. it's obvious. You know, something like that, or a poison tape.
Yeah, but what's so funny is there's a line where Bill Hader is like, the second he took my poison tape out, I said to myself, the first chance I get, I'm going to screw this guy over.
So good.
And there's a beautiful moment where they talk about at the end where Fred Armisen's character is like, oh, did he do it? It would be interesting to find out. Do you think he did it?
Yeah. Yeah, because in the Thin Blue Line, he goes, I guess I never really wanted to know. I never really thought about
why?
It.
What have you been thinking about?
Because he's probably an actual psychopath who doesn't think about someone else's
experience. I can't believe I forgot
to talk
about this part. When they bring in the therapists to evaluate him.
Yeah.
They have him. Okay. They call these therapists Dr. Death. Because everyone that they evaluate, they say needs to be put down.
And really, he gives him this.
Yeah, he'll give you a test.
It's a total dummy test.
It's a bunch of drawings, and they're like, just recreate what I did. And regardless of what you do, they'll say, you're a psychopath, and you'll kill again.
And he said it was he was asked to do the drawings, and then he was asked what a bird in the hand is worth. Two in the bush means.
Yeah.
And there was one other phrase he was asked, and he goes, and I, you know, gave the right. Oh, a Rolling Stone.
Yeah, there's no moss.
Yeah. There's an, you know, and I answered those questions, and then he deemed me a psychopath and with no remorse.
It was just, what's funny is that that question, do you know what that phrase, a Rolling Stone gathers no moss, means? I actually heard that before in the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Mm-hmm.
The doctors asked Jack Nicholson's character that.
So it's almost like either it was a real question mm-hmm. or Dr. Death was such a fraud.
Yeah. I think
that he saw One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest first. And
he's like, you know what? That sounds like a good question.
Yeah. I'll ask... What is a penny saved? Is a penny earned? Mean?
Yeah,
early
to bed, early to rise. It was so stupid and awful. And well, what sucks is that I'm sure Randall did have some things wrong with him,
mm-hmm.
but he just happened to be on the not dangerous side of it. Then David ends up in jail anyway.
Yeah, and Randall still in jail.
Yeah,
even though we know he's. Innocent.
Insanity.
But that was that's what I feel like is hard about all these things is that you want there to be a resolution and a happy ending
mm-hmm.
and there isn't one. And so you're just sort of left with this feeling, like an unresolved feeling a lot of times.
Yeah.
And that to me was the how it ended where I was like, God, I don't even know how to kind of
process.
Because you sort of want to feel despair for Randall, but they didn't really make him an incredibly sympathetic or likable
mm-hmm.
character. Whereas I feel like in a lot of these things now, they try to sway you.
Mm-hmm.
Like in S-Town, where they like try to make the lead character seem really sympathetic and likable. And then they kind of switch it and go like, well, he actually, you know, was all of these things.
Yeah.
You know, and then you kind of switch your perception where they didn't really try to influence our feelings about Randall at all. It just, he was what he was. He was a simple guy who happened to be in the wrong place.
Yeah, this very
time.
Dramatic documentary was weirdly very neutral mm-hmm. in that way.
And I think that that's a difference in storytelling now, whereas like they're just presenting the facts as opposed to like trying to spin it and make us feel a certain way to go on an emotional journey.
Uh-huh.
Whereas this was just like, you handle your own emotional journey. We're just going to tell you what happened.
Yeah. Like the full, like they literally legit show both sides of each person they keep bringing in.
Yeah.
It almost feels like you're a juror in the case.
Right. Which is how storytelling.
I feel like a good documentary should be that way, but I guess.
Well, even the things we see on like, television, like the Friday night line and Dateline or whatever those things are, where it's like, oh, he did and do it. He, you know, like he wished for a better life. Or, you know, he wished Catherine would go out with him. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. And they're
this psychopath didn't hear no.
And they really are like creating. And it kind of dawned on me. I didn't really realize how much kind of the style has changed and it's like a manipulation.
You know right away who the hero and the villain are right from the very beginning and your opinion will not change in most documentaries now.
It just makes me think of how, you know, 20 years from now, the styles will change. And we'll look back at current things and, like, there's no way to sort of foresee, but will it be that things get even faster? And because our attention spans are just going to get smaller and smaller and shorter and shorter, or will we sort of go back to simpler things? I mean, I just feel like, you know, in 20 years, we're going to look at something made in 2018 and be like, oh my God, that looks so dated.
Well, something I am noticing with all these current true crime documentaries is that there is a very visible style of gonzo storytelling that at some point you are very aware of the person putting the documentary together, and they kind of, you see how it affects them.
It's almost their story.
Yeah.
The lens through which they see it, almost like with Serial.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you're very aware that she's experiencing this.
Yeah.
She's having a relationship with him. She's mm-hmm. becoming enchanted with him or whatever.
Mm-hmm. And, you become aware of the choices that documentarian had to make. And I don't know if that's a good thing.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, this doesn't feel neutral anymore. Right. And yeah.
Yeah, because there's so much opportunity. I mean, and even with something like Making a Murderer, they were saying the documentarian left out a lot of information and really, like, skewed it to her point of view.
Uh-huh.
And if you kind of go take a deep dive, you know, on the internet, you kind of see, like, there were pieces that were left out that may have, if you saw those, you would have different opinions. And so it is interesting to think how much influence, but it's like any storytelling. It's like when you tell a story of something that happened to you and you're like, my neighbor is such a shithead. He did this, that, the other. And then the neighbor tells his side of the story.
It's
like, you know, everybody is obviously influenced by their own experience, and the truth is somewhere
in between.
In between.
As opposed to showing the person holding the camera, showing what's it like when you're meeting this person.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Bane?
Yes.
If someone liked this movie,
yes.
What are some other films that you would recommend they watch?
Oh my gosh. If they liked this movie. Well, I guess, I would say, of things that I've watched recently, Making a Murderer. Uh-huh. These are the things I've already mentioned. Making a Murderer, which is on Netflix, podcast-wise, Serial, and S-Town. And then, to me, this kind of goes hand-in-hand with, like, cult documentaries, like Wild Wild Country, which I watched recently, really loved, and then a slightly older one, Holy Hell.
Oh, that's
it's a great one, right? And and to me, it's like different styles, obviously, different beasts. But to me, what makes them all kind of interesting and fascinating is the exploration of a person and how that person went from being kind of a normal functioning kid or, you know, young adult to taking actions that are criminal. And, you know, in the case of Holy Hell, well, actually in Holy Hell, I don't know there's criminal behavior, but in Wild Wild Country there is, where, you know, you're being influenced by, like, a cult leader, and just, like, the journey of the brain and how influenced we are by suggestion. And a lot of times in these cult documentaries, it's like the offering of being accepted and loved.
Uh-huh.
And I find those really interesting.
Mm-hmm. I like
Holy Hell for sure.
Yeah, that's a great one. My only issue with the Netflix series documentaries is that I feel like since they create them into a series instead of a movie, they tend to stretch things out a little too long for you.
Did you feel that way about Wild Wild Country?
I did. I legit felt like the first
they could have told the story in a movie.
Yeah, or not over 10 episodes, because, like, there's legit 5 minutes in the first episode where it's just people being like, I mean, after what happened, I mean, can you blame me? Can you believe that? I didn't think that was going to happen. And I'm just like, how much footage is there of people saying, I can't believe that happened?
Yeah.
And
I mean, obviously, after what happened, here I am. Oh, but, can you believe
but
it?
Everything was different after what happened. And I'm like, guys, I just want to get a red pen and be like, show, don't tell.
Yeah, exactly. You're talking about the people in the town.
Yeah.
Who are still, and they're still reeling all these years later.
Oh, I bet.
But yeah, It is interesting because I felt like Holy Hell was just as a juicy story.
Mm-hmm.
And that was told in what was maybe an hour and 45 minutes or something like that.
Yeah. I know it when I see a doc, because the thing is, like, the more documentaries I watch, I'm becoming aware of bad ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying Wild Wild Country is a bad one. I'm just saying I've seen some that are bad. And it's a shame because I find this is very often happening with true crime, because there's so much out there that, like, I'll watch something and I'm like, oh, this is such a shame because this is a good case and you're telling it terribly.
Right, they're padding it and kind of focusing in the wrong directions. I haven't watched The Staircase yet. I've watched the special that they had. They did like a 2-hour special, I think, on NBC about it. And I've watched that, but I'm kind of saving that for, and again, it might be sort of similar because it's a case that people are familiar with and there's somehow like 10 episodes or something. And I feel like I got the story from the 2-hour special.
Yeah. So I saw the first episode and I was like, I feel like I got
it. You got it. I got it. Like, what else do we need?
It. Man, thank you so much for coming on.
It's my pleasure.
This is probably going to come out in November. Is there anything you'd like to plug?
My gosh, November feels so long away.
You could just plug Twitter or whatever.
Oh, yeah. So why don't I just do that? Okay. So Twitter is just my name, Bain Gibby. Same with my website, baingibby.com. So whatever I happen to be doing in November, you could go on my website then. Seems like a long ways away. And it will give an update.
And I feel like you're in a lot of stuff too.
Well, I'm in the film Lady Bird, which is now streaming. So if you have not seen that, I know it's showing on airplanes. In fact, I was on a flight the other day and I was walking back from the bathroom and I happened to look over and there was somebody watching the movie and it happened to be my scene. And so I, of course, look at the woman to see, like, oh, what's her face look like? And she's in a dead sleep. It was perfect. No, it was perfect because I was like, that's exactly what serves me right. So that, and I'm in Magic To Do every Thursday at the UCB Sunset, which is a musical improv show, 7 o'clock. Super fun. And and then we'll see what happens next.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming. If you liked what you heard, you could rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, and you could email us at indiedarlingspodcast@gmail.com with questions, suggestions for new films, and follow us on Instagram and Twitter at indiedarlingspodcast. Thank you and good night.
Sarah.
And I'm Beth.
And we host Everything Is Rent, a podcast about the Broadway musical Rent.
Every week, we're joined by a hilarious guest to talk about one of Rent's 525,600 songs.
We'll answer questions like, is Rent the best musical of all time?
Has Rent aged well?
Are they not going to pay rent?
The answer to all these questions is yes.
That's Everything Is Rent on Campfire Media or wherever you get your podcasts.
Campfire.